Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome to a special series on the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. I'm Laurel Donnellan here with my dear friend and co-host, Daryl Brown. Join us as we dive deep into our personal journeys, sharing stories from different stages of our lives. In each episode, we'll interview one another about a chapter, starting with how we grew up and ending with where we are now. We will be discussing our history and the lessons that shaped our lives and approach to leadership.
Hi, Laurel.
Hi, Daryl.
So great to see you.
Always great to be with you.
Yeah, and I was so excited to get an opportunity to talk to you about you today.
Thank you.
And also, you know, there's so much that we think we know about a person that we've known for 30 plus years. As I was thinking about some of the questions I'd like to hit you with, I said, well, there's so much I don't know about Laurel Donnellan that I can't wait to ask her.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. All right. And tell us all a little bit of where you come from and how it shaped you, especially those early beginnings.
Well, I come from Audrey and Jean Donnellan. My mother's family was very Italian New Yorkers, and my father's family is very Irish Chicagoans. So they were urban people. And my name actually came from how they met, which I love, and I'm the first of four children. So my parents met at a golf course. I always tell people that if it wasn't for golf, I wouldn't be here. In a little town called Palenville, New York, in upstate New York, where my family had this very old and wonderful family house. And mountain laurel grew in the back of the house on the mountain. And that's why they named me Laurel. So There you have it.
So there was an actual mountain at the back. You know, people, tell us a little bit about the beauty of upstate New York, because I think when people hear those two words, New York, they think of Manhattan, and they don't really understand what upstate New York is all about.
Yeah, well, it's my privilege to talk about Palenville, New York, because it's one of my favorite places in the world. It's the Catskill Mountains. The mountain behind our house was called Indian Head Mountain, and it actually looks like a Native American in a headdress, the rock formation at the top of the mountain. Palenville has some of the best water holes in all of New York State, so I learned to swim in natural water that was freezing cold in May, and I didn't care as a little kid, so we used to swim until we turned blue. And that was part of my memory. So it's across the Hudson, on the west side of the Hudson, and near Woodstock, New York, and it is fabulous.
So it sounds like of a little idyllic upbringing that you had, being the oldest of four. Were you like a ringleader of your yeah. siblings?
Yeah. Maybe they would probably call me a boss, Miss Bossy Pants. Ringleader's nice. So Palenville was where we spent our summers, where my grandparents were. I was very close to my grandparents. My father was part of IBM, and we got moved to Owego, New York. He started in Kingston, New York, where I was born, and near Palenville, and then we moved to Owego, New York. And yes, we had three other kids in fast succession and all very close together. And I definitely thought of the three other kids as my kids more than, you know, as a sibling. I was very bossy and I felt responsible for them in some ways, probably a little too responsible. I remember like making them breakfast when I was like four. So, you know, that's a little odd, but I loved it.
So I take it that you got your sense of taking care of others and caring, loving others from, sounds like a family dynamic.
Yeah, my mother and my extended Italian family were very, you know, food was love, laughter was love, storytelling was love. My mother loved being a mom and she didn't work outside of the home, and we had a lot of fun. She was really the fun leader. I probably was a little more of a disciplinarian than my mother. She was a lot of fun.
So you know, I was fortunate enough to know your mom. Let's talk about qualities that you've gotten from your both your mom and your dad.
Yeah, I like this. I think about this a lot and appreciate them so much. My father is very, very smart. He's, you know, an engineer, was an engineer at IBM. He's 96, still kicking, still learning, still growing. So I learned a lot about valuing thoughts and education and learning from my dad. You know, he's a problem solver. He's very scientific. He doesn't give up on things. You know, he used to build computers and test them for the Apollo program. So there was a lot of mistakes that happened in that process, and he kind of stuck with it and would redo things and redo things. And I think I get that from my dad. And from my mom, optimism and hope. She, you know, and just, she just had a good time. That girl knew how to have a good time, no matter what whether we were cleaning the house or making pies or going shopping, like everything was fun.
So tell me some key moments. I love the way you smile when you talk about your mom, and you talk about swimming in the cold lake waters of upstate New York. Tell me about some key moments that again helped shape you.
My father really liked being in the rural environment where we moved to Owego. He's still there, and he doesn't necessarily enjoy travel and adventure. My mother was the complete opposite. So, for instance, she was a real New Yorker. She lived in Queens, but she always told us, you know, my first job was in Manhattan. So she was very, you know, she was all about New York and read the New York Times every day, and she missed that. So one of the adventures she would take us on, she would dress us up in beautiful clothes and gloves and hats as little kids, take all four of us on a bus to Manhattan, which was like 4 hours away. And we would go to a show, like we would go to Radio City or to a Broadway play, and we'd have delicious Chinese food because we didn't have any ethnic food where we lived. And then we'd get on the bus, and she would do this with tiny little kids and go, you know, 8 hours round trip plus the show plus dinner.
That's an awesome undertaking. Manhattan, four little kids. Yes. Well, first of all, 4 hours on a bus from upstate New York to into the city, and then 4 hours back after a full day in the city. I'm proud of your mom.
Yeah, she was, and it was not hard. Like, that was just what she did. Like, you know, I think about what she did, and yeah, so And she was just so encouraging. She was a creative risk taker. So like in sixth grade, she found this play in Better Homes and Gardens or one of her magazines, and she gave it to me and she said, "You should put this play on at school." And I was like, "Okay, Mom." And so I went to the principal and said, "I want to put a play on." It was The Runaway Presents. It was a Christmas play about presents that ran away, and all the kids dressed up as a tree or a present. And I'd never directed a play. I'd never, you know, I was in choir. I was probably in some plays. And because I had this mother that was all about, you know, just do it, I did it.
Sounds like that was the start of a of leadership.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I guess this is where my bossy pants stuff from bossing around my siblings, came in handy. I learned a little bit about management. I was more successful with other people that were outside of my family. So we, definitely.
Well, join the club on that one. So tell me about school activities and how you did in school activities. Because I take it that you didn't say it before, but you got your intelligence and your smarts from your dad.
Yeah. I think early on, school wasn't that important to me. I was more like my mom. I was more into social things and athletics. She was actually very athletic. She was a great golfer and softball player. And growing up, I was a swimmer. I was a gymnast. I was eventually became a cheerleader. I played tennis, not very well. So I didn't really think about academics too much. And I don't think I struggled in school, but it wasn't a focus until I was 14. Because I had an event that happened to me in 14, and then I got very serious about school.
Ooh, so, I want to hear more about that.
Well, my mom was also like, she so enjoyed taking us to club. We were like, she was a joiner and I was a joiner. So one of my many activities was 4-H. And 4-H has kind of two arms in upstate New York. One is agriculture, so you could, you know, grow things or raise animals and participate that way. And I was in the home economics part. I was part of the Swinging Daisies 4-H club. And my leader was Mrs. Conti. And she taught me how to make pizza and fabulous Italian food. But there was this amazing event that 4-H had when I was 14 that I wish every kid could have, but they took us all to Cornell for a weekend. And they had us stay in the dorms. And then they organized alums to come speak at every school. So we went to the agriculture school and learned about how someone who graduated helped farmers. And we went to the architecture school and learned about someone designing homes. And we went to the law school and learned about what a lawyer does from alums. So it was a really great connection between education and what happens after education. And it was like the perfect time, like 14, before you become too cynical or too, I don't know, it was just perfect timing for me. So we arrived at the hotel school and there was the catering director of the Waldorf Astoria, again, a New York connection, talking about his job. And from that moment on, I went home and told my parents, "I'm going to the Cornell Hotel School." And they tried to talk me out of it. And then my guidance counselor said, "You better get your grades together and you better get your activities together if you want to get into Cornell." So that's when I really got busy with academics. And I decided like being student council president would help me get into Cornell. Like everything was about getting into Cornell. So I was student council president in ninth grade, and I was student council president when I was a senior in high school too.
So sounds like you were goal oriented.
Very goal-oriented. And I had a vision, a very clear vision. And I applied early decision, and I was very fortunate to get in. And I went to the Cornell Hotel School. So because of that trip, that 4-H trip when I was 14.
Tell me more about the chef from the Waldorf, because he seemed to be, you know, we all have individuals who are impactful on our lives.
It was the catering director. I don't remember what he looked like, but he just seemed really happy and enthusiastic about what he did. You know, he talked about organizing weddings and organizing corporate events and being in this historical building and working with chefs, and it just sounded fabulous and glamorous. And I honestly, as a 14-year-old, I thought, I can make a living from organizing parties. That sounds like a great gig.
Sorry.
So it clicked for a 14-year-old, right?
Sure. Well, it sounded like you were doing that all along anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that was sort of like my family, my Italian family's life was that. So.
Right. Right. Well, let's talk about other impacted other people in your early life that impacted you and set you on your path.
I didn't have a lot of women in my life that worked in our town. Most women were wives of IBMers, right? So I didn't really have models of women that went to work every day, but my mother's best friend, Karen Minturn, who's still well, and she's in Chicago. I saw her last year. She was a teacher, and she was a good friend, and she loved her work. And I got to see someone go to work and make money as a woman. So that was pretty important for that day and age. You know, I was born in 1960. So, and I met Karen when I was 3, and she's still in my life. And she went on to do amazing things. She was the assistant to the president of Vassar, and I've just always admired her. And she also had work-life balance. She knew how to have a great life and to have a great work life. So she was very impactful early on. My vice principal, Jerry Lockwood, was amazing. He and I were really partners. I was a student council president, and he was really the principal, kind of hung out in his office, but Jerry was really around. Mr. Lockwood at the time was always around and involved, and he knew everyone's story. And treated me with mutual respect. Like when there was we really like worked as a team, you know? So when there was a problem at school, he would call me in and we would talk about it, like from an organizational standpoint. Or I remember going to speak to the Board of Education about, I don't even know what the issue was, but I was really a stakeholder at the school, and he really helped me develop as a leader and as a collaborator. But he did something really amazing when I graduated. He wrote me a letter about me and all the potential he saw in me.
Wow.
And I carried that letter probably for 20 years. I don't have it, unfortunately. But about 20 years later, I was in a workshop at the Omega Institute, and they challenged you to thank someone that you forgot to thank. And I called him up, and he answered his number, his phone. It was like, you know, it was a pay phone. I called the operator, got his number, and I thanked him for being an amazing mentor and for that letter, because that letter really was a talisman and something really powerful for me in my life.
Sounds like a beacon. Those are the types of things that number one, you never forget, obviously. And you can always look back on and kind of pass on the incident, that remember how it made you feel, and pass that on to someone else. That's kind of the responsibility, right? Right. Have you ever done that yet?
Have I sent letters of appreciation to other people?
Well, yeah, as a mentor, right? Do you feel like you've mentored people in a way that he did you?
Yes, I feel like I do that in my work now. I feel like I do that with my nieces and nephews. I'm very deliberate in seeing them and appreciating them. You know, it's bringing tears to my eyes because I think I got that ability from my mom and from Mr. Lockwood. So I am going to the town where he lives in a few weeks. So I'm going to see if he's still around, because I'd love to go visit him and thank him again.
Yeah, well, if he isn't, maybe a relative.
Yeah.
Maybe an offspring.
Yeah.
You know, because those are the types of things that people need to know about you. Even if you're no longer here, maybe a son or a daughter or a niece,
yeah,
or you know, the daughter of your next door, of his next door neighbor. Somebody needs to know the impact that people like that had on your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyone listening? But I do feel really great that he knows, and he, like, I called him up and I was like, Mr. Lockwood, do you remember me? I'm Laurel Donnelly. And he was like, of course I remember you. And it wasn't like he expected a thank you, but he appreciated it. It was so lovely.
Right. So please, other moments in those early years, it could be pre-high school, it could be high school years, that had a profound impact on who you are today as you look back.
Well, there's some sadness in my family, and I think that that impacted me greatly. My mother lost a baby when I was three. She went to the hospital thinking that she was going to give birth, and she had a stillborn baby. And that was tough on the family, but she got very depressed from that and was hospitalized for, I think it was 6 months. So I didn't have a mom, my great mom, for 6 months. And I remember that and the impact it had on my family.
And how old were you?
I was three. Yeah. And I didn't know where my mom was. I do remember, like, her not being there, my grandparents being there, and my father being very sad. And in the olden days, they used to take the doctors and the priests would take the baby, and the parents would never see the baby. They would never hold the baby. They would never have a funeral. So it came really important to me to heal about that. So I did research and I found where the baby was buried, and I took my mother there. It was probably the most profound thing that happened in my family. And it kind of broke my family. You know, years later, I know that doctors and therapists and healers do things differently for families when they lose a baby like that. But it was very, like, sweep it under the rug like it never happened. So at a very young age, I felt profound loss and grief. And that also continued when I was eight. I lost both of my grandmothers. One I was very close to, my Nana. Very suddenly, she died when she was 58. So I lost my Nana. I lost my grandma in Chicago, which was my dad's mom. I lost my great grandmother. And we lost as a nation Martin Luther King in the same year. And I remember eight years old saying, "This is the worst year of my life."
At eight.
At eight.
Yeah. Well, that those are tremendous losses.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about that. I think because it's Juneteenth and because the conversation we had about your upbringing last week, I'm very grateful to have been in a family that taught me about Martin Luther King and revered him. Because it wasn't necessarily the history of my family to do that, but that was my mother and father really breaking a cycle of racism. I remember my grandfather being racist. I imagine, you know, my father grew up in the South Side of Chicago as a, you know, Catholic white boy. And he had profound experiences with, and he had to work very young, and he had these profound experiences with Black men at work who took care of him, and he got to know them. And anyway, it was, I feel lucky that I was brought up by parents who understood that everyone wasn't being treated fairly, and that we had our part to play in that.
Say more about your part to, what was your part to play in that?
Well, even though I was 8 years old, it really was drilled into me that we all had to vote, and that not voting was bad, and that we had to support people that were fighting discrimination, and we had to vote for people that were supporting women's rights and, you know, civil rights for everyone.
So equality was big for you.
My grandmother was a suffragette, so she had to, and my great-grandmother and grandmother in Chicago were suffragettes, and she didn't get to vote until she was 25, and she fought, like she marched and fought, and so in my family, especially from my dad, understanding what was going on, and he's also World War II and Korean War vet, right? So loving our country, supporting our country, but also looking at our country with open eyes and fighting for change in any way we could was part of my upbringing.
So you were born in 1960.
Yes.
Which means you missed Camelot because...
I was very tiny when Camelot was happening.
You were tiny. Yes, yes. But you didn't miss the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Watergate.
Oh, I remember Watergate.
Right, right. All times that I felt America was changing then, right? America, our culture was changing. So what are your thoughts on that? You were 10, 11, 12 during those times. And did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I remember my parents and I watching the Vietnam War, and with a lot of criticism about that. I remember when, you know, I was very young, and they used to report how many Viet Cong they had killed. And I remember with my brother saying something like, "Oh, we're winning, we're winning." And my father shutting the TV off and sitting us down and saying, "Nobody wins when one human being dies. Nobody wins." So,
what a great statement that is, right? Because that's a lesson in humanity.
Yeah. And He and I have not talked at length about his service, but I know that he volunteered when he was 17. He asked his parents if he could leave school early to, so he's very much a patriot and also has thought a lot about the idea of war and how it's antiquated and how it is doesn't make sense for the world to be at war. So I remember, my parents being supportive of ending the war, of peace, of being very upset with the assassinations, and sadness being in the house because of it. I remember after school, I think I was 12, watching Richard Nixon say goodbye and being relieved, for some reason that was happening and that justice was being done in its way, So, I was in a house where what was going on in the world was talked about. Like I said, my mother read the New York Times every day. My father still watches news from morning, noon, and night, knows everything that's going on. And I do remember, we were kind of aligned with the hippies and we dressed like, we wore peace signs and macrame and bell bottoms and we spent time in Woodstock in the summers. And so I think I was a little bit of a hippie in my junior high years.
Well, that was my next. I was going to tap into that because those early late 60s, early 70s, there was a cultural shift, right? And you may have been a little too young to really appreciate it. I don't know, but if you were a hippie in junior high, I guess you weren't too young.
No, I was wearing Indian shirts and had long hair and yeah. I mean, I remember, we were close to Ithaca and so there were protests going on at Cornell and Moosewood was so like vegetarianism was coming in and anti-war and anti, killing animals and yeah, things were changing. It was very different from the 50s when you move into the 60s and 70s.
Right. So you've painted a very idyllic type of childhood, Laurel. Save for the deaths of your two grandmothers, the death of the stillborn sibling. Were there other moments that
Yeah.
made you feel not so good about life?
It's always difficult to talk about your parents in a negative way. Like I want to be real and I want to be, I don't want to edit, but I also want to be respectful. I think my parents had a very tough marriage. They were not, they were very different. And they fought a lot, and there was alcoholism and mental illness in my family, and that affected everything. My mother made things very nice, and things could have looked nice from the outside. And my father worked very hard and supported us, but I think they both had, demons that they were working out while they were raising children. And that created, a lot of anxiety. I felt a lot of responsibility and anxiety from a very young age. And I had an eating disorder that started when I was 12. Probably started younger than that, but I remember being bulimic when I was 12. So, and I abused alcohol from a very young age, probably also around 12. I had my first boyfriend when I was 12. I was smoking cigarettes when I was 12. I was drinking alcohol. I kind of led a double life because I was struggling with anxiety and addiction, and I was also like student council president and the cheerleader. And I did both very well.
And it seems sometimes when we could do things to excess and still produce, then why stop either?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk about this in my next chapter, but it really didn't, I didn't really get recovery, help and recovery until I was in my early 30s. So, what started in my teen years as periodic became something of a problem in my 20s. So, and my parents, of course, did the best they could. They loved us, they supported us, we definitely had a middle class life and never, we were never hungry. We were never without clothes or things. We had a safe place, a safe environment, safe town to live in. But they had their own struggles and really didn't see what was going on so much with me, and I also was really, really good at looking good, even to my parents.
Yeah, that's an art that we all perfected.
Yeah.
And back then, if we look good on the outside, sometimes that was just good enough for our parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So lessons in leadership that you've gleaned from those early years, could you share with us?
Yeah, I think a lot about my management style with my siblings, which was Miss Bossy Pants. And it's kind of funny that I run a company now called Compassionate Leader Circle. I had some pretty tough leadership positions early on in life, student council president, ninth grade, and 12th grade and student council positions in between. I really learned that your words are really important and you have to be very deliberate with the people you're influencing all the time, because even as a student, people listen to me. So I learned very early on that I couldn't be sloppy with my words or my intentions or my promises. I literally had someone who wanted to impeach me when I was student council president my senior year. I remember her name being Pam. I don't remember why she wanted me to be impeached. I think it was because I wasn't following the Roberts Rules of Order. I was being creative in how I was running meetings. But I do remember somehow making amends with her or having a great relationship with her. Like, we ended on a high note and we worked it out. So yeah, as a leader, you are visible. And people are watching you, and sometimes that feels unfair, but with influence comes responsibility.
That it does. Okay. Well, Laurel, I really want to thank you for spending this time with me. I've learned more about you. I love it, and I look forward to the next chapter in your life.
Yeah, I look forward to yours as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.